Hello, my name is Ari Onis, and I'm with the Office of Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and this is Multifaithful. On this week's podcast, I am joined by John Hurst, the director of the LGBTQ Student Center here at NYU. We are doing this podcast because it is LGBTQ History Month in the month of November, and we're going to talk a little bit about the history of LGBTQ student centers in higher education and how the work in LGBT centers and some social justice work overlaps with religious communities and some of the history of religious communities working with LGBT communities here in the United States. Thanks for listening to Multifaithful and out of this week's conversation. I am joined today by John Hurst, the director of the LGBTQ Student Center here at NYU. John, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me. This is great.
And I'm joined by one of our favorite repeat students, Hannah Leffingwell. Hannah, I don't think you've been on this year. Can you introduce yourself again?
I'm Hannah Leffingwell, and I'm a PhD student here at NYU.
Great. Yeah. So John, we are doing this podcast now, because it is LGBT History Month, and we're recording this a few days after National Coming Out Day, and it's also the 20th anniversary of the LGBTQ Center here at NYU. Okay. So I was curious if maybe to start, for people who aren't as in the higher ed world as you and I, and Hannah, could you give us a little bit of context as to the formation of LGBT centers within institutions of higher learning, higher ed, how they came about, how the one here came about, and sort of what their role is on campus, and what do they do for a campus?
For sure. Well, thanks for inviting me to be here, a part of this conversation. Thanks for doing your homework and knowing a little bit about the history of the center and Coming Out Day and LGBT History Month. And in my circle, your podcasts are quite legendary, as they would say, so I'm kind of excited to be a part of
it. Is your circle with my grandmother?
She might have consulted on this a little bit. A few other people. So, 20 years. 20 years. This is very exciting. This month marks for the New York University LGBTQ Student Center 20 years of existence and providing services and support and education for queer population here on campus. Higher ed in general, today, 2016, out of 4,600 colleges and universities in the country, including community colleges, we still only have about maybe 200 centers like this. Mm. That's about 4% that have full-time staffed, full space and a full program offerings for students. Only 4% of them still have it. And you can imagine what it's like on campuses for the rest of those students that don't. This wave started around mid-90s, about creating LGBT spaces on college campuses. As a counterpart, you know, multicultural centers, mm-hmm. African American centers, you know, they came out of that the late 60s, early 70s, and kind of movement around that, ethnic studies programs, those kind of things. But it was much, much later, and part of that is about where the society was, right? You had mid-90s, you had Ellen DeGeneres, right, and her show. I mean, I think about Newsweek magazine. And the cover of that, I'm Gay. I don't know if anyone, Newsweek had an actual magazine, right? I think that was around, 96 or 97? And in some of those times, we begin to see centers start looking at, universities start looking at, how are we going to provide services? Along with other kind of things. You had Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We had DOMA. We had the first Clinton administration, right? Which there was just a kind of thinking that was happening in the United States about, it became more conscious about gender and sexuality and how we're going to provide services, but then it began to have such a backlash of moral majority, all of these other kind of influences. So I think colleges and universities began to say, this is what's happening in our political system, that we have, even with a Democratic president, that we have these kind of really tough legislative pieces. We've got to begin to do something. So you see larger schools like Michigan, Indiana, Ohio State, them beginning to have some of these kind of programs and centers. Around 1998 is really when you begin to see a major push for other schools to begin to do that. NYU is part of what we call the first 50, and it's that first group of 50 colleges and universities that began to have centers. And really, we're probably in the first 15 of them that began to do that. We have the oldest LGBT student organization in the country.
Really?
Along with Columbia. Now,
are we allowed to admit that?
I dare not speak the name, right? And it's really only about a couple of days because the students that were running here and doing this activism, one of which was the famous Rita Mae Brown, they were running with the Columbia kids, and they were all together, and they said, we've got to do something. Well, the Columbia kids just happened to do it a couple of days earlier, and so really, they were starting at the same time at, you know, the Village and all of that's happening in here, Stonewall and all of these folks. So,
right, well, I mean, we're recording this literally down the block from
Stonewall. Three blocks.
Yeah. And so I wonder how much of NYU being at the front or how much of the early activism at NYU do you think had to do with NYU literally sitting in a hotbed of LGBT activism in New York City?
I think it had everything to do with it. I mean, I look at pictures. I have been going through boxes of old things as we begin to move this stuff to the library to be archived. Because what we found is, you know, we're 20 years, so I was called the library and I said, well, what do you have? And they had nothing. They knew nothing about the creation of it, the start of the center. They knew nothing about some of these things. Now, they have a lot of great LGBT things in the library.
Yeah.
A lot of collections. There's a wonderful porn collection and some other things that came out of some stuff. The gallery that's there and the director of one of the institutes that's up there. But they didn't have anything about the center. So we had all these boxes of information, pictures, 20 years worth of pictures, and the first check that came to start the center. So as we began to send that information over, I was going through boxes, and every picture, every mention, there's a Sylvia Rivera. There's Sylvia Rivera out on this is obviously earlier than 1998, but you see all of these figures that are in, that when we talk about queer history, that are NYU community, whether because they were outside the doors or because they were a part of, they were a student here or they were somehow connected. Rallies that happened where we have NYU students taking pictures with Sylvia Rivera and some of the other kind of activists there. So I think it has a lot to do. It has a unique place because it is here in New York City, in probably one of the queerest, if not the queerest cities in the world, maybe, and at a fairly queer supportive institution. I mean, so it has a unique kind of place in this 200 centers that are like this, and its role today moving forward of what we continue to do and activism, that town and gown, as we like to call it, in higher ed.
So, you know, we're talking a lot about why these centers needed to come about at that time, but what is your perspective about why they're still so important, especially at a place like NYU, where often people think like, oh, NYU's so, you know, forward thinking and inclusive. So what is the purpose of still having these kind of centers?
Well, NYU is very forward thinking and a place that I think is supportive and does it really well for LGBTQ students. Now, having said that, we still have inherent challenges, right? Because we live in a world where understanding not just sexuality, but the construction of gender and the complexities of that is still very real. And our queer students on this campus are supported, but there are still significant challenges. It's one thing to how we create policies and laws that change conditions, and I think we're really good about that here, but how we change hearts and minds and how we create the conditions where people are affirmed in who they are and then empowered and supported, that's why we still need centers like this. This is why you still need an African-American cultural center. This is why you still need a women's center, even though we don't have one at NYU. This is still why we need these places, because in a society that still has a heteronormative, that heteronormativity is the go-to, cisgendered individuals run the place, set the terms. We will always need a place where we can affirm the identity of an individual and then empower and support them. And even when there is full equality and equity, whatever that is, like whatever we get to that, there will still need to be a place for individuals who look like me or share my own identity to celebrate each other just in that space. Yeah. My life should not be constructed or determined based on or in opposition to a straight individual. Mm-hmm. I should be able to celebrate my life with the folks that I have. So these are why some of these centers still exist today. And to continue to educate and to dismantle what are the systems of oppression mm-hmm. that keep, in this particular case, LGBT folks marginalized and underrepresented and still in the closet, if you will. I mean, it's just an interesting thing, because how long have we been talking about race in this country? How long have we been post Jim Crow? How long have we been post slavery in this country? And we still look in 2016 right. where you would think that we were had done no work on this. Mm. As we continue to see black men murdered mm-hmm. by police. So why are we talking about race? Because it's intersectional. When we see today, we have had marking yesterday, 28 black trans women alone in this year murdered. So when we talk about what are these centers, well, these centers represent mm-hmm. the work that we need to still be doing in right. this world around gender and sexuality.
So I wanna actually jump on this point, because I know we want to talk about intersectionality mm-hmm. today a little bit. But before we get there, at least when I was in college and sort of just based on my age, when I became, I think, aware of like the LGBT community and rights for the LGBT community, everything I learned at the outset and really informed any early care I had about it was focused on marriage equality.
Yes.
That was the, right, that was the issue.
Yes.
That issue has been won. Yes. At least in the United States, mostly, not perfectly, but mm-hmm. I think clearly that issue has at least gone over a certain hump
yes.
and is not something that we really need to, I highly doubt it's going to revert anytime soon. So for people who maybe aren't as steeped in this world day to day, now that the marriage equality fight is no longer the absolute single centerpiece, mm-hmm. What are some of the issues that both LGBT activists, LGBT centers at universities, like what are some of these issues that people maybe aren't as aware of? What are they? Because I think a lot of people actually think like, oh, marriage equality, the fight's over, like it's sort of it's no longer as pressing an issue mm-hmm. and therefore we don't really need these centers. Like I think that's a large instinct there.
Well, let's just, and Hannah definitely chime in. Mm-hmm. Let's just be clear about one thing. In 1970, Sylvia Rivera stood out on a stage in Washington Square Park, and her famous speech was, to all of those white LGBT persons in the audience, this is not about this kind of acceptance, corporatization of this. And if we focus on that, we will miss this. So the idea that marriage equality was always the mm-hmm. main issue, I just want to dispel. That has never right. been the issue.
Right. Although not surprising that me as a straight white cis man, having learned about the issue, that's how I would have learned about it at first.
And it makes sense. I think there was a conscious decision around folks who run the queer kind of or LGBT social justice movement, mm-hmm. HRC, mm-hmm. Some of those kind of organizations that are often led by white cisgendered men, to say, what is something that connects all kinds of, it connects our religious aspect, it mm-hmm. connects a mm-hmm. financial piece, mm-hmm. it is about capitalism, marriage is about mm-hmm. a contract of capitalism,
tax benefits.
Yeah.
So there was a decision there that we could get. And then who, I have a right to love who I want. You can't get better of a message than that. But people warned us about this. The message of a queer movement has always been led by brown and black trans women. That is what Stonewall was about. Mm. That night, that bar, that moment. That is what that movement has always been about. So what we have done is that we're trying to get back to the mm-hmm. heart of the movement where it started, with black trans women saying, I'm fed up with the police brutality, I'm going to resist. And so it got co-opted like many social justice mm-hmm. movements get co-opted. So now we're talking about why we still, what's on the table are the same things that have always been mm-hmm. on the table. How can I be my authentic self and be able to live in a world and without any kind of interference with that? And that's about gender and sexuality and those things. So what if you can get married? Who can afford to get married? Mm-hmm. That is a real question about this. Martin Luther King said, so what if you can get in the restaurant if you can't afford the meal?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And when he began to talk about poor people's campaign and these economic things, there began to be a backlash on him about that. I think you see the same thing here. As we begin to recenter voices and begin to talk about economic justice, we begin to talk about racial justice, we see those are queer issues. That is the queer movement. Black Lives Matter is the queer movement. Mm-hmm. You know, so what's next? Why do we still need to do this? We still need to do this because women make less than men. Black women make less than white women. Hispanic women make less than, you know, that is why, you know, because Audre Lorde said, we are not single issue people, right? So we have all these issues. I am black, I am queer, you know, I am first generation college student. So those are the issues. Mm-hmm. What are the issues that we're facing in this world in social justice are the queer issues. So the students that we see in the LGBT center here, they're talking about affordability. Mm-hmm. How do they pay to come to this institution, right? We have this notion that these centers are a place where folks are coming to negotiate and understand and develop their gender identity and sexual orientation. That is the dramatic change from centers 20 years ago and today. Mm. That may have been happening then, but today we have more information than we ever had. Our students have coming already developed Tumblr pages and talking about this in communities. Our students are coming having already established, negotiated, and clear about their gender identity and sexual orientation. They are coming to our center to say, what are you going to do to create the space for me to operate in who I am? Hmm. Now, there are still developmental things because of where they are as individuals, right. You know.
Still come at 17 or 18.
There's a lot of development. Let me make that clear.
Yes.
But it's not that piece. It is about how do we allow them an opportunity to have an agency in their life and then to give them space to operate in that agency. That is what our centers are doing today.
So I think what you just did is you like laid out, I think, really clearly sort of how these different issues intersect. I feel like for people who aren't steeped in the higher ed world, the word intersectionality is one of these buzzwords that you either love everything that comes after because that's your world orientation, or you immediately think like silly coddled college students who can't make, like, right? Like you kind of have a very polarized reaction to it. And I think you kind of laid out a much more nuanced approach to it. So I want to turn the intersectionality conversation a little bit towards religion and spirituality because... I think most people listening to this know religious communities often have a very complicated history with LGBTQ movements. Some of the worst instances of hate crimes or just instances of bias come from the religious world. Mm-hmm. And there are also instances of religious communities being homes and like wonderful places. So if you could sort of in big picture view, and then we can jump in together today, in your work both on campus and just general advocacy work, what is the role of religious groups or religious folks within sort of LGBT spaces? Are they, is there still some friction, or is it more unified? Like, how would you evaluate that?
Well, there's friction. there's trauma. Yeah. There are memories, there are scars, there is healing that needs to happen in that. I think it all depends on the center. Mm-hmm. I happen to believe as a worldview, as a perspective, a point of view that, you know, spirituality, this component of that, is a part of making us whole individuals, right? And it should be there. And definitely as it relates to an offering of programs or services, we should have that there for students who want to have that connection. The reality is that many of our queer students come with rough experiences in their faith communities, whether it has been in, you know, just a separation from their faith community, or just real spiritual violence within their faith community. And that is real. And so our students come with a, I don't want to hear anything about religion and spirituality. And even to bring it in this space says it opens up something that they have not fully dealt with. And it can be a challenge to have that in the space. We have and have had for a long time the notion of queering faith as a part of what we do in the center. Now, the challenge is that it has been based on who is the director, and if there is a particular interest, for me now, it is a particular interest for mine. So we have done more around that, but it hasn't always been that case in the center. And that, I think you find that around centers all across the country, that it has kind of a love-hate relationship with that.
Yeah.
Here at NYU, again, that has been a part of the work that we've been doing in the center for some time. And now that Global Spiritual Life is here, and since its creation, we have continue to build that relationship there and to figure out how we do this and how we offer this. But let's be clear about a couple of things. There is no mainstream African American major denomination that has come out as an affirming LGBTQ in queer lives and their full participation in church life. Not one African American. So we can look at the Episcopalians and Lutherans, and there are some of the mainstream Christian denominations there that have done that. But this is one of these areas of the work that needs to happen that still needs to be done. And we can see throughout our history, there are times when faith communities, theology has been used to marginalize, oppress, and to even sanction the elimination of groups of people. But we look back on those moments and we say, wow, what were we doing? You know, and not too long ago, Southern Baptists just gave an apology about the role they played in slavery and their resistance to some of these things. And I mean, not that long ago, as in 5 years ago.
Right.
So this is not to come down on them, but it's just to say we look back on that moment and say, wow, what did we do as it relates to that? I think we will look back on this moment and say, wow, what really did we do as it relates to queer folks in our faith communities and our theology? I really do believe there is this opportunity where, you know, whatever you believe, I think there is always revelation to happen, and there is always moments where we can change and we can grow. And I think that is the hope, and this is why we have Queering Faith in our center, so that for those students who believe that spirituality and faith is an important part of their life, that they are able to reconcile that within themselves, and they are able to come back to that, so that there is a full reconciliation within faith communities with those folks that have been lost. You know, as an African-American queer person who came from a traditional African-American faith community and that loved it and was a huge part of their life, to be separated from that and then to go find another place to worship, to live, how does one sing in a strange land?
Right.
You know, when you go, and many of these open and affirming churches are white. So that is great that those places exist. The MCC Church, the Unitarians, you know, the all of these places where there are open, that is absolutely beautiful and wonderful. And in those spaces, we can see the transformative nature of those things. But we cannot separate, because it's the intersectionality of our lives, we cannot separate race and these other things from that. So, yeah. I mean, it's a very complicated thing, but I mean, we see today, I think what sometimes frustrates me is that it's this pass that we give around some of our faith communities about where they are on these things. And we see that here on our college campus, that we give a pass to allow what is just homophobia, transphobia, that we then have couched and we talk about it in a different way. I know this is very complex, so I don't want to come too definitive about to have too much an opinion about someone's theology, but it's problematic.
This just makes me think of, you know, this debate that has been going on for now a while of trigger warnings, you know, and people being, this idea that college students are coddled, that creating safe spaces is impossible and that we shouldn't even try. And that they're going to get into the real world and nobody's going to care about that.
Yeah.
And so we shouldn't do it in the first place. And I'm kind of wondering your thoughts on that, considering what you just said about the way that the university kind of acts as a space where there are certain regulations and rules to keep people in a space where they can be themselves, to allow them to be themselves. And I'm just wondering your thoughts on this kind of, we're seeing the backlash to that right now.
Oh, well, this is a great topic because we've talked about it quite a bit here lately. So I have a few thoughts about this. As it relates, part of the challenge, I think people just misunderstand what safe space, what a safe space means. So let me just address this coddling piece. You talk to a 21-year-old student that came, that comes to NYU from Valdosta, Georgia, and you talk about from the age of 10 or 11, they've sat in a faith community or a church or in a family where they have been told who they are is not only your life here on earth is will be, is limited and impeded, and your afterlife. You have no afterlife either. That is condemned, that you are immoral, that this... Don't talk to that student about being coddled. This is not about... Safe space are not about being coddled. This is about the abuse and the trauma that exists in this world because of systemic racism, homophobia, transphobia, and all these things. This isn't about a student being coddled and, oh, give me a trophy because I played on the T-ball team. This is about what the violence that has happened to groups of people. This is about... What people, we have people that live in families who tell them that some of the most awful things. So they come to an academic community where we want them to be free to engage in a rigorous academic program. This is about the conditions of what make that possible. The same way about how we set up a classroom and learning environments is about this notion of a safe space. And the safe space being not ever being challenged. Queer students don't have an opposition to being challenged. They have been challenged their entire life. This is about, will there be a place where they can see someone else and be empowered? The safe space is about being empowered and so that we don't continue to do any harm or create the conditions where they can never be successful. The first time I ever in my life had an African-American professor or teacher in front of me, all of my education is when I went to an historically black college. Some people will say, in a day and age today, why do we need historically black colleges? Or why do we need women's colleges? Which is the equivalent of safe spaces.
You just made hell.
Okay. I went to a women's Mount college, Holyoke. So like, yes, preach.
You know, it's because you want to make sure that the student makes the connection. Yes, that is a PhD woman or a college president that is a woman, or that there is a place where you can be affirmed and be empowered, and that your queerness can be celebrated. And that in this space, there is no, you can have an opinion, but we do have a belief that some of that language is hate speech. Some of that language is counterproductive to creating conditions for even an intellectual conversation. We have all of the time complex and challenging conversations in the LGBT center, but it is not a space for you to come in and talk about you being gay, you're going to hell. Yeah,
right.
If that is the speech that you want to bring into our space, no, this is a safe and protected space that doesn't have that in there. So that's the safe space.
I want to finish on, because I picked up on a language thing that I think you did that I don't even think you noticed.
Okay.
But when we were talking about religion before, and you, when you were talking about LGBT students, you flipped the word to spiritual needs. And because what I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, what I think you're doing is reflecting a kind of an approach a lot of us have, which is in the United States, we often associate religion with like institutional religion and spirituality with more of personal expression and individual things. And so I actually want to ask about the religion, like institutional religion for our last question. And think there are obviously certain religions and certain types of groups within religion are doing much better than others at being accepting. And every religion has a spectrum of approaches. And you're going to get a wide range no matter where you go. So in moving forward, and this is sort of a process question, one that I think about a lot is there's sort of an, I feel like there's an in-between place that a lot of people reach, which is sort of the love the sinner, hate the sin type place.
Which is not in the Bible,
as their right, and that's sort of a landing place for people who who wanna hold on to certain theological beliefs but don't wanna hate someone who's queer. And within the queer community, and within, I think, queer allies, that position is incredibly problematic for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. And we can put some resources in, like, the show notes to explain why, because I don't want to focus on why that's problematic. Yes. But I'm curious, if you have people who have landed in that place and you're trying to get them to a place that you would consider of deeper allyship, what's the best approach for that?
It's a really good question.
Thank you. I thought a lot about it.
And let me just be clear. What I'm getting ready to say here may be more just my real own personal views on this. Now, that can't be separated from the fact that I'm the director of the center and all these things. But, so first thing is, you said this idea of moving them to a deeper allyship. Mm-hmm. Let me just dispel in my belief that one cannot be an ally holding the belief that we separate the sin from the sinner. That I can love the person and hate the sin. That there's no allyship in that. Let me just be clear about that. So I can't move you to a deeper allyship because you're not an ally. So I know that is that will hit someone's ears and be like, oh, I just want to be clear about that. There's nothing else in the statement that if you think you are showing up as an ally to an LGBT person, but internally in your heart or as the root framework is, I love you, the person. I just don't like your sin. I just want to say to you out there, America, or the world, you're not an ally. That's not an ally. You may have a desire to want to get there, but that's not allyship. And let me just be clear, when I'm talking about finding an ally, I don't go to the person and says, I like you enough. That's not the ally I want. You know, so that's not someone, no one's looking for that. Now, that's the first piece. But the other piece is, so how do we take them from where they are to where they need to be? That is the challenge that I have all the time, because I deeply believe that I think all the time, what will be my role around social justice work for the next 20 years, right? I feel that my entire life has been about social justice and about doing this work from the time I knew that I was queer to the first debate I had in class around these things, to marching, to all of these things all my life. I have thought, I really want to focus more on this idea of healing, of wholeness, of how we do this kind of peace. Ask this question. If you are legitimately serious about how to move yourself, what does that look like? Because the old me would be, you just need to move there. That is wrong theologically. You got to fix that. And when you do, come on. Right. But so I think the first step for me is what I've begun to try to understand is, the first thing is, if there is a personal connection and I know you, it is then hard for you to hold that space, I think. So part of what I try to do is, and this just happened not too long ago, is to say, let's not talk about any of that other stuff right now. Let me just find out, what's your favorite color? What do you like to eat? Tell me about your kids. Tell me about this. Tell me about why you decided to become, you know, a pastor. Tell me about your belief, to understand more. So in my understanding, right, where there is no compassion, show compassion, you will find compassion. Mm-hmm. So when I often meet individuals like that, I have to sometimes temper down this activist part of me and to say, okay, how can I approach this through real empathy, through real trying to understand? I think try to start there. And when we begin to build that connection, then the hard work begins about, okay, how do we move them from that? I think part of that is to be very clear about some things to the people that we are trying to build that relationship. You are not an ally. That is not what that is. I mean, I think for me, that has to be very clear, because people will justify a lot of things. And I think if that's not clear, really what we're talking about allyship is not this notion about you having a badge to be an ally. Allyship is about the work one is committed to doing, continued education, that I'm showing up to disrupt, dismantle, or to stop the system that is in place that impedes LGBT persons. If at the heart of who you are says that sin is problematic, immoral, I don't like it, and I want to erase that from you, the LGBT person is saying that what you call the sin is my innate identity. It's who I am. So how can you disrupt, dismantle, or stop if that is where the core of that is? So, I mean, the next piece is, and I talk all the time whenever I'm in the front of the chaplains, because I deeply respect as much as I may disagree with certain theology, I respect that the way in which we construct this world for many people is rooted in their moral and religious beliefs. And I don't want to come in and just say that your thousands of years of history and theology and all this is wrong, and it's, and you are wrong for that. But I just want to be clear, there's a disconnect. Mm-hmm. So I say all the time to our chaplains, where there is this theological gap, let's find where we can be in agreement on. When we can talk about student success and where we can create the space and agree on that, I think there can be some easy wins and some development mm-hmm. there that can ultimately grow into right. something else. We have many examples around this throughout our time where when there is true relationship and understanding mm-hmm. of people, it is hard then to construct these very yeah. odd ideas that we get in our head about justification mm-hmm. of really just marginalization and hate. I mean, because,
Right, and that's and it's one of the, I feel like that's one of the, social justice has been, I feel like, part of at least the conversations I've been having in a higher ed space yeah. more frequently in the yeah. last year and a half than it had been
yeah.
prior, as I think student activism has taken, especially even at, it's gotten to a whole new level, and I have so much admiration for that. And one of the things that I think is really hard in a social justice conversation, social justice work, is the process and how, right? Like, these process questions are just so yeah. complex because it sometimes comes down to just series and series and series of one-on-one conversations and yeah. questions and these big mm-hmm. events, then follow-up one-on-one conversations and questions. Yeah. And it can be a long slog.
Yeah, and part of it is about the institution or the place or whatever being clear about their values and mm-hmm. who we are. Because part of it, what happens is that we're so ambiguous about these things, not us, NYU, but we often right. are ambiguous about these things, that we don't clearly articulate what our values are, who we are, and what are the terms of engagement here in this community.
Right.
We have policies on paper in these things, mm-hmm. but when we are not clear, it often invites people that are into our community that will never move on these things, that will never be open to changing, right? So one of the things about having clearly articulating our values and what we believe, it puts it out there and says, hey, if you're gonna be a part of this community, you might have to bend a little bit in order to be a part of this community. Instead of saying to the marginalized groups, you've got to accept all of these things. We should be talking about the people that come into our employment, the people that come into our community, and be clear to them what our values are and what we believe and how you have to operate here. And at the end of the day, this is an intellectual academic community. So curiosity I never understand people that are within faith communities or within religious communities who lack curiosity, who lack the notion that things are fixed. I mean, the very notion of there being something beyond this means that it is limitless, boundless. It is can be any and everything, mm-hmm. right? To believe that somehow these things are fixed and that there is no curiosity about what if there is no new developed seems to be the exact opposite of what should be there in a faith community and definitely in an academic mm-hmm. community like NYU.
Yeah.
So if for no other reason for the conversation or the intellectual piece about this community, should we be having spaces like mm-hmm. this, and should we be pushing folks to move? Not just our students. We talk all the time, how do we construct transformative experiences with our students? And I'm saying all the time, how do we construct transformative experiences for our staff mm-hmm. and our faculty? Because we have this idea that it's the students that need to be moved. So the question is, with our conscious students and our students that are thinking about this and are critical about this, who will they meet in our offices, mm-hmm. in our classrooms? We heard from the listening session who they're meeting in the classroom.
Right.
So there's challenges there, but there are challenges with capacity and understanding for our staff here. So we have got to do things even with our chaplains, mm-hmm. even with our even when theologically there is a gap, we have got to do all we can to continue to push them to a different place if that's what we believe as NYU and as this community. And I think that is what you believe. I think that is what the Global Spiritual Life staff believes. If that is the case, it is our responsibility. And I welcome any opportunity to engage with you to continue to figure out what that looks like, to push our people even more under the guise of what's wrong with more justice, equity, and full inclusion of our folks in our community. What could be wrong with that? And in my opinion, what spiritual, supernatural God would be against that? So I think it's our responsibility to push those folks. Is it easy work? Nope, never said none of this is easy. Is it short work? Nope, it's a long game. That's the critical place and where we are in the legitimate question to ask. So is it better? Yep. That is not the model of where we need to be.
Right.
Is love the sinner, hate the sin, better than
just hate?
Just hate? Westboro Baptist? Yeah. But it sure ain't the model, or it ain't the model in my head of where we should be in the long term.
Well, John, thank you. This has been really fun.
Yeah.
Hannah, as always, thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. Especially like to thank our guests, John, and our student Hannah for joining us on the podcast, for spending so much time with me this morning. So thank you to Brian Young for editing and producing the episode. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes, and we look forward to having you back for another episode in 2 weeks.